The story of Daniel thrown into the lion's den has been a favorite of many through the ages. It has been immortalized by generations and by the scriptures themselves, which include by inference this grand event in Hebrews 11, the Hall of Faith, where it states, "Who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions." Many artists have illustrated this event. I have concluded just two here and a couple later. The main concern is to realize these were real lions and this was no Hollywood show. As we arrive at this story, Daniel is in his 80s now. He is old. He has survived many unusual and major events. He has survived and weathered the many storms and persevered through a lifetime of upheaval and struggle. He has survived the death of two kingdoms, Israel and now Babylon. You can see the age of Daniel when we come to chapter 6. He's probably about 85 years of age. That's not a fair age to have anybody thrown into a lion's den. Not that any age is good for that, but there we have him, about 85 when he comes to this event. And he has survived the death of two kingdoms, Israel and now Babylon. Triumph and success have not made him proud. Conflict and rejection have not made him bitter. Old age has not sapped his usefulness. His life from childhood to old age is an example of what God can do with any person in the most adverse circumstances. Now in his mid-80s, Daniel stands on the pinnacle of prominence and responsibility. It is here that he is called upon to meet a great test, just as he was called upon in his youth when faced with a critical decision. But now Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon are gone. They're buried. Daniel has been brought into the administration of this new kingdom, the Medes and the Persians. And so I have a little chart here to show you how big the Mede and Persian kingdom was. It was large. It was probably roughly about the size of the United States of America today. It was a huge kingdom. And so we enter the story in chapter 6 of Daniel, recognizing that Daniel is now in his older age. He's in his second kingdom. He has survived the death of Israel and the death of Babylon. Now he is called upon in a leadership role in the Medes and Persian kingdom. So let's look first of all at Daniel's promotion, verses 1 through 3. Verse 1 says, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom and 120 princes who should be over the whole kingdom." So we find that Daniel's promotion is in a kingdom that is a very prominent sphere, large domain. It's a large kingdom, big government, 120 provinces. By the time Esther comes around in 30 to 40 years later, it grew to 127 provinces. So you know we've got 50 states in America, so think in terms of the provinces like states, and there's 120 of them. And so there's a proficient strategy that is applied here in this government. In verse 2 it says, "And over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto them, and that the king should have no damage." So he sets up three presidents to oversee these 120 provinces. Makes good sense to use Daniel, because Daniel was a foreigner to Babylon. He was not he didn't have any loyalty to Babylon from his early days. And so he has served in government. He knows the city and he knows the people. He has some clout. And this favorable prophecy that he gave in chapter 5, which said Babylon would die and that the Medes and Persians would come and take over, they probably remembered that this great prophet had said that. And so they employ him, and this invading empire that was common in those days, they would employ some of the local people in administrative roles to win the people over in their government. So they select Daniel, and it's a very proficient strategy at this point. But we see that he's also dealing with a political struggle that's going on here. The political struggle, notice the last phrase of verse 2, it says that the king should have no damage. Why would a king have any damage? What would cause damage to a king? Politics are involved here. The king is apparently concerned about the human nature of these politicians who naturally desire to gain personal power, which might bring trouble to the king whom they serve. The king planned a promotion for Daniel over the others because he trusted him. But he is in the middle of a political struggle here, which leads us then to this preferential supervision. Notice verse 3 where it says, "Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm." Daniel was given preferential treatment because he had an excellent spirit in them. You can almost feel the jealousy rising in the hearts of his colleagues from this promotion. These wicked men discovered the king's plan to promote Daniel, and they rushed to create a roadblock. They are all out in an all-out blitz to try and undermine this guy. They want the promotion. They're worried about this Daniel guy. But we find out very quickly why they're upset about Daniel. It's because of Daniel's purity. Because of his purity. Notice verse 4, which tells us that he was favored. In verse 3, it tells us that he was favored because of his excellent spirit. And that excellent spirit is just one of those intangibles that it's hard to put your finger on. Sometimes you like a person because they just got a really neat attitude and spirit. Sometimes you get bad vibes about a person, but you can't explain it. True Christians should display the Holy Spirit in their lives. And when we do that, an excellent spirit should shine brilliantly. You should also, at that point, find favor. So his purity is because of his favor, but also he is faithful. Verse 4 says, "Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could not find occasion nor fault, for as much he was faithful." He was faithful. That is a powerful statement to be given about any person. I wonder if that is a quality that could be said about you. That person is faithful. Proverbs 20 in verse 6 tells us that faithfulness is a rare find in a person. It says in Proverbs 20 verse 6, "Most men will proclaim everyone his own goodness, but a faithful man who can find?" A lot of people are great at their talk. It's hard to find someone who is faithful. David and Solomon agreed with that. Daniel was a man that was faithful. His purity shines bright, not only because of his favor and his faithfulness, but also because of his faultless spirit, his faultless life. Notice in verse 4, it is mentioned, by the way, three times that his being without fault or without error. See if you can pick those out in verse 4. "Then the presidents and princes sought to find occasion against Daniel concerning the kingdom." So they had their microscope on him. They were seeking and trying to find some kind of fault with him. But it goes on to say, "But they could find no occasion nor fault, for as much as he was faithful, neither was there any error or fault found in him." No fault, no error. This guy was a wonderful man. This is almost too much to believe, to find somebody that is without fault or error. Only Christ is the one that we could look to that said there was no sin, no errors in his life. But about Daniel, it says that. He had a magnificent reputation. Daniel lives in the midst of evil corruption, in polluted politics, yet he maintains a pure and a faultless life. This is no easy task. We look at the politics, at the world around us, and we look at people, we see somebody coming up, and we don't trust them because we say, nobody is like that. Daniel was. It's possible, it is possible, folks, to keep one's integrity and purity even in the political arena today. It is possible. Daniel showed us how to do it. William Law says he stands out like a fair flower in a barren wilderness. And when we see somebody that stands out in the wilderness of our politics in the world today, we say, wow, they have the reputation of a Daniel. That's what we look for today. But Daniel's purity is quickly going to be dealt with in the devil's plot. The devil has a plot to bring anyone out that tries to live a holy life and pure life. And here it is in this story. He is very devious. The devil is devious. Notice what he does in verse 4. It says, they couldn't find anything wrong with him. They were seeking to find something wrong. That's the first thing the devil tries to do. He is the accuser of the brethren, it tells us in Revelation. He is always seeking and watching to find fault in your life as well as others. And he's motivated by a wicked lust for power. People that are seeking to find fault with you, it's because they have a lust for power themselves. And by the way, make sure you check that in your own life. If you're constantly looking for fault in other people's lives, maybe it's because there's a secret jealousy, there's a sin, there's probably something deeply rooted in you that needs to be cleared out. You should not be trying to examine and judge the lives of other people. You should be carefully examining your own life and making sure that it is what God wants it to be. But these guys are devious. This is typical of the dog-eat-dog world of business and politics today. Climb the ladder of success by stepping on other people. Move up the ladder by making others look bad. Finding their faults and pointing out their errors. It's a jungle out there, and the devil has all kinds of people that will do his devious work. Evil men never tire of seeking new ways to attack good and righteous people. They sneak up on them right while making bold assault from the left. They work through government as well as business, through schools, through private organizations, and even churches. They come up from within as well as multiply from without. They are part of the devil's hordes of hell. The devil has an evil plan every day to bring your convictions and your walk with God into compromise, or to make you suffer for it. If he cannot catch you in sin, he will attempt to persecute you for your faithfulness to God. And that's what happened with Daniel. They couldn't find any fault with him, so they made it a plan of attack to bring him down because of his faithfulness and his relationship to God. And so the devil's plot is devious. It is also deceitful. It is deceitful. At the root of deception is the word lie. They attack Daniel on the rules of his religion. They employ deceit. They secured, get this, a ban on prayer. They came up with this lie and fostered that so that people started believing that prayer is a bad thing. That's a lie. That's a lie of the devil. Prayer is a good thing. Verse 5 said, then said these men, we shall not find any occasion against this Daniel except we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Then these presidents and princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. Don't you just love the way they come up there? They are so slick, so smooth. Oh, king, live forever. Can't you just taste the sarcasm coming off their lips, although they're trying to sound so righteous and pious, so supportive. The king looks at them and says, wow, these guys really love me. They want me to live forever. How about that? As long as, so they tried to ban prayer from the kingdom. Doesn't that not sound like what happened many years ago in America when they made a decision to ban prayer from where? The schools. You remember that? Somebody else came up and said, as long as there's final exams, there will still be prayer in school. They didn't succeed. But you know what? They succeeded in some ways in getting a public prayer banned. And they took some people to to court over that. There was a coach out in the state of Washington that would take his football team at the end of games and kneel at the 50-yard line and just invite whoever wanted to on either team to come and pray with him at the end. And the school fired him from his job and kicked him out. Now that guy decided to fight back, and he went to the court, and the local court said, no, the school has the right to do that. He took it to the state court, and their Supreme Court said, no, the school can do that. They took it to the Supreme Court, and finally the Supreme Court says, no, the school doesn't have the right to do that. God should have priority, and if a coach wants to pray, he can pray. And if he wants to invite others to pray, they can pray. But he had to go through all of that devious attack by the devil to get it back and to get his job back. Perhaps Daniel wasn't too scared about being thrown into the lion's den because he had been living among evil lions in a wild political jungle for a long time. The devil's plot is devious, it is deceitful, and it is deadly. Notice what it says here in verse 7. All the presidents of the kingdom, governors and the princes, the counselors, the captains have consulted together. All of these great, marvelous, wonderful politicians, we've gathered together and we agree on something, King, to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, except of thee, O King, shall be cast into the den of lions. Anyone that breaks this rule, death. Death. Kill him. Of course, notice how they slip that in. You can't pray to any god or man except for the king. Oh, they appealed to his ego, didn't they? And so it's deadly. They made a plot to kill Daniel. That was what it was from the beginning. They weren't just trying to get him out of the kingdom. They wanted to kill him. It happened to Daniel. Do not be surprised, by the way, when persecution strikes. We have seen it here in this nation the last couple of weeks. We should not be surprised by that. It happened to Daniel. It happened to Jesus. It happened to the prophets. It happened to the apostles. Jesus said it would happen. In fact, he said in John 15, if you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, I have chosen you out of the world. Therefore, the world hates you. You got to understand that. If they have persecuted me, and they did, they will persecute you also. If they have kept my saying, they will keep yours also. But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they know not him that sent me. They don't know God. John 16, Jesus gave instructions and encouragement about that. When you find that happen, he said, these things have I spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world you'll have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. And we can be overcomers for the world too. It should not be surprising that an evil world hated Charlie Kirk, who spoke the truth and about Christ with boldness and love. And even though he has been murdered, there are still many malicious people wanting to speak evil about him. Such talk exposes clearly that they side with the devil against Christ and his followers. They claim that Charlie preached a message of hate. But the opposite is obviously true. How do we know that? Because Charlie never called for the murder of those with whom he disagreed. He didn't say kill them. But with many whom he disagreed are in one way or another celebrating his death. So you tell me, who has the hatred in their hearts? I'll tell you, it's the one that wants to kill and the one that did kill and the one that thinks it's great that he got killed. Now, you may get angry about that, but do not fall into the devil's trap with them that spew out hatred. Jesus said, love your enemies. And Paul further expounded that command, saying, be not overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. When you have hatred and it spills out, that is the sure sign the devil's found a foothold in your heart. When you are persecuted, let the blood of God's love bleed and let people see your love. Daniel is overcome with this wicked plot of the devil. Which leads us now to Daniel's prayer life, because what is it that they wanted to get rid of? What were they so scared of? Apparently it was his prayer life in particular. The king signed the decree in verse 9, and we see in Daniel in verse 10, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did previously. Then these men assembled, found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Daniel's prayer life was pure. It was pure, his motives. He did not try to fight their evil plan with politics. He didn't rally the Jewish faithful to march on the king's palace or push his agenda through the media or lobby groups. No, he quietly practiced faithful obedience to the King of Heaven, which demanded civil disobedience in this case. He had a higher authority. Oh, you aren't allowed to pray? Excuse me, I'm sorry. God told me to pray. I have a higher authority. So Daniel's prayer life was pure. It was also private. Notice where he went. He says he went into the house. He went into his house. Here again we gain a peek into Daniel's private life and find the hidden secret to his greatness. He prayed. He prayed. He was a man of prayer. There is both a private sense here and a public sense, his window being open. Apparently that's the way he always did it. And apparently those that snooped around his house found out and figured that out. We can catch him. A public enough that when someone tried to spy on him, they could find him. But we get the sense that Daniel was not trying to hide his prayer activity, but he wasn't making a spectacle of it either, of his civil disobedience. Prayer is a private matter, folks. And that was his intent, to keep it private. Notice Daniel's posture when he prayed. It says in verse 10, in the middle, he kneeled upon his knees. He kneeled upon his knees. Solomon knelt, the Bible tells us. Jesus knelt, the Bible tells us. David knelt in prayer, it tells us. Kneeling signifies humility and reverence and dependence upon God. And he gave thanks, very significant and noteworthy in the context. I would tell you that kneeling is not the only posture that you can use and employ in prayer, but I tell you what, it's a good one, and I hope that there are times when you do kneel. I don't kneel often in our public services because I don't want to make a prayer a spectacle thing. I don't want people to say, oh, wow, what a wonderful man of prayer. But I do kneel a lot in my prayer time. Why? Because I know it's good for my old nature, my ego, my need to realize that I am humbly supplicating an omnipotent God, and I am in desperate need of his help. His posture is a good thing. Notice his practice. Did you see what it says it happened in verse 10? He kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks. It says, as he did aforetime. This was his habit. This was the habit of Daniel. He prayed 3 times a day. I think I call Psalm 55 David's Psalm, and I also call it Daniel's Psalm. I think that Daniel was reading the Psalms, and he read Psalm 55 one day, where David said in verse 17, morning and evening at noon will I pray, and my prayer shall come before thee. And Daniel said, wow, if it was good for David, it's good for me. I'm going to pray 3 times a day. Some people think that must have been they prayed for breakfast and lunch and dinner. Maybe that's where it all started. I don't know. What I do know is he was frequent in his prayer ministry, And you and I ought to consider the significance of that. Paul said, pray without ceasing. We ought to be in the spirit of prayer and praying constantly. What a habit. What a daily practice. What a major revelation to us today who desire God's power and blessing on our lives. We usually think in terms of getting things done in our abilities and what I am able to do. Daniel had no clue what the next few hours are going to take on for him. What he did know was he was dependent upon God for prayer, and he prayed. I am committed, I'm convinced that one of the biggest issues for Christians today is the lack of prayer. It's a constant challenge in my own life. I have to frequently push myself hard to pray. I think it's the last thing on your agenda that the devil wants you to do. It ought to be the first thing on your agenda when you get up. And you ought to recognize how desperately you need to pray to make it a priority. And nobody can tell when you are faithful in prayer, except it does begin to show up because it changes your life. Prayer does change things. The first thing it changed is the life of your own life. If you want God's help in your life, really work in this ministry of prayer. That was Daniel's practice. His prayer life was not only to practice every day, it was also very passionate. Verse 11 tells us that he kneeled and prayed and gave thanks before his God daily. That tells me it was passionate. You don't pray all the time unless you're passionate about something. Making supplication, begging God for help, for wisdom, for guidance, perhaps praying for the king and for those who were gathered to spy on him. I think he knew all about that circumstance. He was praying, Lord, you know what's going on. You know what these guys are trying to do. You know they want to kill me. You know all about it. You know the rule, but I'm praying. You've got to work. James 5:16 says, the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. As I was praying through that prayer one day this week, it just hit me again. Lord, it says, the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. And Lord, you know many times I don't feel very righteous. Help me, first of all, to be a righteous man. Cleanse me from my sin and make me pure and help me to be a holy man. And then help me to pray effectually and fervently, not just ticking off a list of things on my prayer list. Oh, bless the missionaries and bless the pastor and bless my neighbors and bless my parents and bless my family and bless those. You know, God, grip my heart with a real burden for these things. The Bible tells us that Jesus, in his days on earth, prayed with strong crying and tears. He was very passionate about the things that he prayed for. David, we find him often crying. Samuel, it said, cried all night to the Lord once. Have you ever cried to the Lord in prayer? His prayer was passionate. It was also personal. This is something I don't want you to miss. Look it in your Bible and circle this phrase. You'll find it at the end of verse 10. He kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God. Circle that phrase, his God, as he did previously. Then verse 11, you find it again. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Circle it. His God. It was personal. He prayed to his God. You know, those people, all of them had gods, and some of them prayed to very different gods. Prayer only works If you are personally connected to God, he must be your God, not just Daniel's God, not just Pastor Spink's God. He must be your God. Nothing defines the level of greatness in a person more than their prayer life. Nothing defines greatness in a person more than their prayer life. And maybe that's why this last story about Daniel, the personal story, is at the end of his life. He had developed a habit through life of being a man of prayer. And this whole story revolves around the fact that he prayed and he wouldn't stop praying even when his life depended upon it. That's what made him great. Your genuine connection to God, the God of heaven, is determined in the private moments of your life when you commune with God. That's what makes a person great. And anyone can do it. You don't have to have great talents. You don't have to be a great singer. You don't have to be able to get up in front of people and preach. You don't have to teach a Sunday school class. You don't have to do anything that people look upon and are watching. All you need to do is talk to God and commit yourself to it on a daily basis. The story moves on quickly, and we come to the fact that there's a death penalty. There's a death penalty for people that pray. Oh, the death penalty in verse 12. Then they came near and spoke before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man shall ask a petition of any god or any man within 30 days except thee, O king, shall be cast in the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Then answered they in verse 13 and said before the king, that Daniel, the one, you know, that Daniel, that guy, the one that is of the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth not thee, O king, nor the decree that thou hast signed, but maketh petition three times a day. That's the guy. He broke the law, king. That little bad guy, the one that you really want to promote, he's a bad guy. Look at what he did. He broke the law. The penalty is there. I have three sections in this section that I have defined. The death penalty, it comes from liars, laws, and lions. Notice the liars. They document Daniel's prayer time, and they bring their report to the king. Yep, we found him, we caught him. They had Daniel exactly where they wanted him, and the king was cornered. The king suddenly saw what their whole plan was. They were all a bunch of liars. He had been fooled by their deceptive, lying plot. Lehman Strauss said it this way: the fake flattery of the presidents and princes had done its effective work, and the pride of Darius had made him blind to his better judgment, realizing that he had been made the dupe of their duplicity. The king was sorely vexed within himself. By the way, they revealed their racism in this verse. Did you see that? By the way, they identified Daniel. He's not a part of our kingdom. He's one of those outsiders, one of those bad guys from Judah. He's one of them Israelites, those Jews. Instead of calling him by his official title as the first president under the king, they belittle him as that Daniel of the captivity of Judah. They're liars. Notice how they employ their laws, verses 14 and 15. Then the king, when he heard these words, was very much displeased within himself and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. The king wanted to save him, but he couldn't because of those stupid laws. That bad law that got passed, and he himself had been duped, and he signed it into order. Then verse 15, then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed. You remember how that's one of those big laws, king? It's been established. You can't change it. Verse 8, verse 12, verse 15 uses the same phrase, which altereth not, the laws of the Medes and Persians. That became a phrase that has been used in American sometimes. The law, well, I suppose that's one of the laws of the Medes and Persians. In other words, you can never change that one. That's what we Baptists are all about, you know. You can't change the Baptists, you know. That's in our Constitution. It's like the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Well, he couldn't change it. Evil men are experts, by the way, at finding ways to employ laws to accomplish their wicked schemes. Even the best laws men construct today will still be abused by wicked, scheming liars. There is a glut of lawsuits now in the courts aimed at obstructing the good plans of conservative governing. I don't know if you've paid any attention, but a lot of the executive orders that President Trump has put in place have been rules and edicts to try and change some of the wicked laws that got passed by previous administrations. He's trying his best to get those fixed. You know what? The laws of the Medes and Persians are at work. The devil is doing his job. Why would we expect anything different from him? Separation of church and state. That's a good law, isn't it? That's a good one. But not the way that the evil, scheming, and liars are using it. You know where that came from? That came way back at the beginning. Our founding fathers said, we don't ever want the government to override and tell the church what they can't do, what they can and can't do. And we don't want churches that come up and put their hand and start working and controlling government. There ought to be a separation of church and state. But what these liars and schemers today are trying to make that into, a separation of God from society. And they think anything that has the name church or closer to the church, if it's God on it, we got to get, no, that's separating the church and state. No, it's not. What you're trying to do is you're trying to kick God out of our society. You're trying to kick God out of our government. And so that's what these evil, scheming liars do. Oh, the First Amendment. It's all about free speech, right? And they want to use it to blaspheme and attack the religious right. The old nature knows no law, someone tells us, and the new nature needs no laws. No matter what law you pass, the devil's going to find some way and some expert to go around that and come up with something new that's going to turn into a bad thing. Human laws, by the way, God is not bound by human laws. Never forget that. And he's not limited by them. He can overcome any law. The king tried to find an escape clause, but he couldn't. Which leads us to the lions now in this death penalty. Verse 16, then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. Now the king spoke and said unto Daniel, thy God, whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee, won't he? Your God can do this, can't he, Daniel? Verse 17, and a stone was brought and laid upon the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. Now he's thrown into the lion's den, the king of beasts. Male lions can grow up to 550 pounds. They are faster and much stronger than man, and their paws can knock out a full-grown man cold with one brief swipe. And they're filled, by the way, with razor claws, which rip open the flesh of its victim when attacking. It is fierce, it is wild, it is a dangerous beast. The den was a cave-like opening which could be sealed at the side opening, and it had an opening at the top, perhaps 15 to 20 feet down. It was used apparently quite often as a means of capital punishment. In verses 16 and 17, we find that Daniel is shoved into the den. The stone door is locked into place and sealed, and Daniel's doom and death seem sure. As the king set his seal upon the door, no doubt he heard the loud roars of the pack of lions circling their prey. This action was nothing less than murder by deceptive law. But we quickly move to the divine protection of this Daniel. Divine protection, and I want to look at three things, especially in this section, the comments that were made in verse 16. At the end, it says in verse 16, "Thy God whom thou servest continually." Daniel had served God faithfully. It says that again in verse 21, Then when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice, and the king said to Daniel, "O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God whom thou servest continually able to deliver thee from the lions?" It's a statement of hope. I hope. I've tried to save you, Daniel, and I can't. You're left only with your God. Your God is the only resource left. Is your God able to deliver you? There's a comment that is important. He realized that God had been served faithfully by Daniel, and now the question is, will his God protect him and deliver him? There's a contrast also in verses 18 through 22. There's a contrast I want you to see with the king. In verse 18, "Then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. And the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions." The king was a prisoner of politics. His conscience was screaming at him and blaming him for his own foolish pride for allowing this to happen. He couldn't sleep, and he could find no relief from his guilt and the sick feeling from his troubling tragedy. His was a night of terror. He was in a prison of sorts, in a den of lions of his heart. But Daniel, in the meantime, verse 21, he tells us in verse 22, "My God has sent his angel and has shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me, for as much as before him innocence was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt." In the long hours of that night, as Daniel stood face to face with those deadly killers, that lion's den actually became a paradise because God sent an angel to protect Daniel. How did it go through the night? You ever wondered that? Did Daniel sleep? Perhaps. Did Daniel rest his head on one of the lions? It's possible. Did he sing and pray like Paul and Silas when they were in prison? Perhaps it was an all-night prayer vigil, praying for the king and for those men to get saved. Whatever the case, while the king's night was traumatic and a nightmare, Daniel's night was peaceful and comforting. And that's what happens when you go to God in prayer. He gives you peace, which passes all understanding, even when you're facing death. Notice the charge in verse 22. Daniel says, "My God hath sent his angels to shut the lions' mouths." In Psalm 91, the author tells us that God will give his angels charge over thee to protect thee in all thy ways. And David believed that, and Daniel believed that, and God sent an angel to give him the charge over Daniel. "I'm putting you in charge of Daniel. You protect that man tonight. Not one claw is going to rip flesh in him. Not one fang is going to get on him. He's going to come out of there perfect, and I'm holding you responsible." Perhaps it was Christ himself, like the deliverance of the three in the fiery furnace. They shut their mouths, and apparently they calmed their paws too, which could easily have killed Daniel. And that leads us to a confirmation, by the way, of this divine protection. Verse 23 says, "Then was the king exceedingly glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him because he believed in his God." Nothing. There wasn't one scratch on him. Not one fang bite. Not one bruise. There was no manner of hurt upon him. Can you imagine? They inspected him and they looked at those lions and they thought, "What in the world? How did that happen?" But I want you to see that it was a miraculous work of God. How do we know that? The very next verse tells us. Verse 24 says, "Then the king commanded, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the lion's den of lions, and their children and their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them and broke all their bones in pieces before they came to the bottom of the den." Those lions were hungry. This was not a matter of them having been too fed that they didn't care about Daniel. This was a miracle. And it proved by the fact that probably 20 to 30 or 40 of them were killed by those lions, that den of lions, as soon as they got Daniel out. This documents that it was a miracle indeed. This could not be rationalized away as some having an attempt to do by claiming the lions weren't hungry. And that's what some liberal scholars do. They say, you know, that's not a miracle. Yes, it was. Those lions were hungry, all right, because they killed the next prey. Which leads us to the conclusion of this chapter, divine preeminence. Divine preeminence. What do we see it in three ways? Universally in verse 25, then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. The whole world is going to hear about Daniel's night in the den. God employs a pagan king to share this great message to all the world. His kingdom is to be feared. It was universal and it was unending. Verse 26, and I make a decree that every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble in fear before God of Daniel. For he is the living God and the steadfast forever in his kingdom, that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. It is an unending kingdom of God. Daniel stands as a symbol of God's unending preeminence and sovereign control. As Daniel survived the rise and fall of world empires, and as the evil schemes to destroy his leadership and life, so also our sovereign God survives and controls all kingdoms and nations and people. His sovereign preeminence is universal, it is unending, and it is unrivaled. Verse 27 says, he delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Daniel survived through it all, and God wanted him to survive to prove that his power, his sovereignty is unrivaled. God delivered him from the power of the lions. He delivered him from the Babylonians. He delivered him from the Medes and the Persians, and he can deliver you, folks, from the lion of hell. In 2 Peter, 1 Peter chapter 5, it tells us, be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary, the devil, walketh about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. The devil's out there praying and wanting to take you down, but you can be delivered from him, as Daniel was delivered from the lion's den. I want to conclude this morning with a quote from T. Fred Hussey. Pastor Hussey is one of our former assistant pastors here. And he did a series of studies on the book of Daniel many years ago, and he sent me the cassette tapes. That tells you how long ago it was. And I have that, and here's what he said as he concluded this study this morning, and I quote with it. There was a man who came to earth in his life. There was a purity more white than Daniel's. He too was a man of prayer. He too became the object of jealous hatred. He too was condemned as an innocent man, not to a den of lions, but to a cross of shame. And there upon that cross, no angel brought deliverance. The devil, that roaring lion, was given free sway to do his worst. The ugly jaws of death swallowed him up in a den of earth. And a stone was rolled across the mouth of that den, and a seal was set. But in the morning, when women came to weep, the stone was rolled away and the den was empty. In dying, the lion of Judah broke the bonds of death and rose triumphant with death blows forevermore upon his body to mark his conquering victory in rising from the dead. He grasped from Satan's power those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage, to lead them in triumph through the skies to their father's home and his glory forevermore. Praise God for the Lion of Judah that overcomes the lion of hell. Amen. Three applications this morning. Trust Christ. Align with his eternal kingdom. He is the king and his laws can never change. He has determined who will live forever and who will be thrown into the den of hell. He is the one who can protect you from the powers of hell. Trust Christ for salvation. Trust Christ for daily guidance and protection. Trust Christ. Secondly, pray. We cannot escape the necessity of prayer and the need for prayer. Be a man or woman of prayer like Daniel and like David and like Christ. Be a prayer warrior. Finally, be courageous. Do not fear the evil schemes of wicked men who hate and desire to destroy Christ's followers. Be faithful and be bold. And a faithful prayer life, by the way, will enable that courage. May God help us all in that way.